Welcome to MCBI's 60 Mark, a podcast for curious thinkers.
Well, welcome everyone back to our next 60 Mock podcast. It's Marina here from MCBI, enjoying what I like to do best now on Fridays, and that's interview amazing South Australian leaders and hear a bit about their views and insight around perhaps some of the more nuanced parts of leadership in their own career journeys. And I'm joined here today with a great friend. I was thinking, how should I introduce you? I thought, I'll reveal that we have drunk red wine together. But quite seriously, I'm delighted to be able to interview Dr. Jagan Krishnan. Welcome, Jagan.
Thank you, Marina. It's pleasant to be here.
Isn't it? Down here in the basement, down a little secret hidey hole of Adelaide.
Yes, with the headphones on. And
I know. You're looking all official there. Yeah. Well, it's much better than scrubs because they sort of gross me out a bit, to be perfectly honest. But welcome. And we're going to have a little time together and have a chat, and we're really interested to learn a bit about your professional background. I'm very lucky I know a bit about it, but I know a lot of people would be delighted to hear your story and where you came from and where you are right now and how you ended up literally in a basement in an alleyway in South Australia. So would you be so kind as to share some of your story?
Look, I was born in Singapore. My parents are from India, and so I was born in Singapore, and then in the early 70s we migrated to Australia, and we migrated mainly because of education. Singapore was going through a phase at the time where they were trying to entrap their intellectual capacity by teaching major subjects in second language, so you couldn't go to an English-speaking country. And my father thought that that wasn't good for the family of four boys and one daughter, so he decided to come to Australia. And so, our major drive for coming here was education. Mm-hmm. And so from that point of view, it was a very good move for the whole family. My eldest brother is a VP of a research company in biochemistry. My elder brother is a professor of ENT surgery. And then there's myself. My younger brother did law, and he's now managing director for Australia, Oz Harvest. And my sister lives in the US, a mother of two children. So
it's a family of underachievers then. Wow.
Yeah. So education was the driver for coming to this country. So from that point of view, I think we've been lucky, and Australia has been very good to our family in general, and therefore we're very conscious of wanting to give back and put back in. So my brothers and I and my father as well have always been very community conscious and working out ways of contributing back to broader issues in Australia, and also doing overseas work and so on.
Because you have quite an impressive pedigree of overseas work. Perhaps some of the areas or countries that you've worked in.
Yes.
So Rwanda.
Yes, look, my journey to be involved in overseas work started in 1995. For various reasons, I ended up becoming a secretary of the Asia Pacific Orthopedic Association. So that basically linked up close to 20 countries in the Asia Pacific region involved in orthopedic education and training. And so that opened doors and opportunities for me to travel into the Asia Pacific region, particularly China and India. And while I was doing that work, I also got involved with an organization called Specialists Without Borders, which was involved in, again, education and training, but this time focused in Africa. And so in 2005, 2006, I started working in Rwanda, visiting Rwanda, starting up some education programs and training programs there for about 6 years. And then after that, I got involved in the College of Surgeons in of East, Central and Southern Africa, and through that also got involved in education programs and set up an exchange program with Malawi.
Mm.
So that was sort of my African sort of experience. But I still do quite a lot of teaching in India and also with China. But recently I've just come back from a visit to Bhutan, where I worked with a volunteer organization called Interplast, and basically working with a team of plastic surgeons looking at treatment of burns, contractures, and congenital deformities and hand injuries. So I'm looking forward to potentially working with a few international organizations to try and support and develop education programs in Bhutan as well. So
that's fantastic.
So that's my recent venture.
How do you see, I mean, you're very passionate about education and, mm. you know, helping people to help themselves. But yeah. Where do you think that came from?
Look, I think, you know, as I said, the primary driver for us to come here, and my father has always been pushing education. So that's, you know, been a major sort of driver that seeded all of this. And both my brother and I, you know, we're all always involved in education and training programs. But I think, you know, it's that sort of, you know, as you know, in the Asian mentality and particularly in India, education is seen as the, you know, as the major focus in most people's lives in terms of social and other developments. So I guess it's that sort of, you know, almost intrinsic drive for better education.
Mm.
And to, you know, it is a privilege. I see I see being in a position to be an educator as a privilege. Mm. Because you know, you don't get the knowledge without a lot of people investing time and effort into you. So it is actually paying it forward.
Yeah, it is,
and,
isn't it?
And that's how, you know, I've got involved in education and
yeah.
training.
It is. It's a fascinating journey, and I believe you've also spent some time over in Harvard.
Yes.
Completely stepped away from the medical field, instead dabbled on the dark side. Tell us about the experience at Harvard.
Look, I went to Harvard mainly, again, for education because, you know, I'm getting to a stage in my career, and as a surgeon, you can't keep operating forever. You know, some people do think that they can, but I think there's a limited time where you need to consider other options. And that's where either being in education or looking at broader thinking. And that's why I went to Harvard, to the business school there, to do one of their executive program, MBA programs, to broaden the way I think, meet new people, young people who are exploring and challenging paradigms.
Mm.
And it was really one of the most stimulating educational things I've done for myself, because it's really a selfish thing when you go to study. It's all about yourself. And so I just found it a fantastic experience in life about learning.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought, that we study and it's a selfish thing.
Yeah.
But it is, isn't it? You know, you acquire the knowledge and your life is different.
Yes.
As a result.
Yes.
But it is far. I look at my son sometimes and think, I wish it would flip for you. It is not.
Well, I'm 57, so it's taken a long time for it to flip for me.
Yeah. Oh, he's got a few
years.
He's got
hope.
Yeah.
He's got hope.
Which, thinking about the old and the new and all these young years coming up through, there's a lot of discussion globally that old problems, or the problems that we're facing, will not be solved by old ways of thinking. And I know you're very, you know, passionate and have thoughts around the new ways of problem solving. Can you share your thoughts around that?
Yeah. Look, I think, you know, it's a term of the past that to be a contributor to change, you need to be a lateral thinker. But to me, I think these days, dimensions of thinking and problem solving have quite expanded, particularly with the access to knowledge systems and artificial intelligence and so on. So I think to be a thinker these days, you've got to think in several dimensions. And lateral, I think, is limited. And I think so when you're faced with a problem, I think you need to firstly look at it circumferentially around that limited sort of zone in which the problem presents, and then step to the next level and look at a global solution to that problem, which not necessarily is limited to that sort of field, but broader fields. And then once you've done a global assessment, then look at the sort of translational aspects of the solution to that problem that not only will have impact in the immediate industry you're trying to solve the problem in, but other industries that surround that may benefit from the way you think or the paradigm change you're trying to implement. And I think people need to start thinking in broader dimensions of change rather than a limiting to just thinking, I'll just think a little laterally and look at what I can do to change the current situation.
Does that also apply that there may be answers to problems within a certain sector that may not exist in that sector? You have to look over the wall and go, actually, they're doing it like that over in automotive. Maybe we can apply some of that learning over here in medicine or arts or whatever the case might be.
Yes. Look, I think a little bit of that's starting to creep in now into medicine. As you know, there's robotics.
Yes.
And then there's artificial intelligence. There is a resistance to that sort of change because people are afraid of that dimensional change and are concerned about the impact that it has on their personal careers. But I think what people should be looking at is, again, their primary focus, which is the patient. And if you look at the patient and say, how do these changes benefit the patient, and then work your role into that, you become more relevant than being threatened by the change. And so the way I look at all of this so-called perceived threat is that actually they're opportunities. And the more engaged you are, and the more involved you are in defining the roles of those new technologies, the greater your primary goal benefits, which is your patients, and therefore you continue to be relevant. So I think to be obstructive of these changes because of fear actually damages the service to your patient, but then also marginalizes you.
Yes, yeah. It's interesting. It brings back into focus the purpose of your job, doesn't
it?
Exactly. If you've got that anchor there, you can appraise things very differently.
Exactly, yes. Medicine's all about patient and patient care.
Yeah.
And I think if we keep that as our primary focus and use everything globally around us to facilitate that, patients benefit, but two, from a personal point of view, you always become relevant.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm just going to ask you a very quick one on a moment maybe in your career where something happened, good or bad, that really sent you on a new direction.
Look, I guess there were two major points in my career because, you know, it's been a long, nearly 40-year career. So major points of change. One was when I first came back from overseas after furthering my fellowship training in orthopedics, very quickly, you know, within a year or two of me arriving back, and I was 32 then, I was made head of the department and professor of orthopedics.
Isn't that Flinders?
At Flinders University. Yep. And that was a major sort of impact because it's made me stop thinking about myself and having to think about everyone else. So when you're running a department, it becomes about leadership again. I think it becomes less about you and more about everybody else. And to me, that's always been the best model of leadership. And so at a very young age, well, I think it's very young, 32.
I think it is. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I was sort of put in a position where I was, you know, made to start thinking in that context. It also then made me start to open up the department to global interaction, and that's why I got engaged in things like the Asia Pacific Orthopedic Association, being involved in overseas training. All of that was to make our department a part of the global community. And so that sort of thinking started, you know, at the age of 32 when I just got back, and then developing other surgeons and getting them engaged in the department and a commitment to public medicine were all things that I had to address then. And then the next major point of change was, again, you know, at the end of my stint as being head of department, when I left Flinders as the head of department, though I'm still at the university, was to do the Harvard program to broaden my whole scope of thinking and trying to utilize what skills I've gained in the past to engage in things like artificial intelligence and other business opportunities.
I think you are very you're an excellent example of a lifelong learner, trying new things, exploring, and I suspect a lot of it is in your DNA anyway. a pretty amazing family too. Well, our time is now coming to a close. That went quick, didn't it?
Yes, oh,
we'll just have to. Isn't it incredible? Just as we say goodbye, go back to our Fridays in South Australia, over here in Adelaide. Just if you got any key takeaway, maybe a quick thing you'd like to let professionals across the board think about, things they might want to consider when they're looking at their own career.
Yes. Look, I think the first thing that I would, you know, I've got a young daughter at that stage, and it just brings me, is self-confidence, I think, and self-belief and commitment. And as you know, and also hard work.
Yeah.
You know, hard work beats intelligence, as far as I'm concerned, because you can make up for intelligence by a lot of hard work.
Mm.
But being intelligent doesn't necessarily make you productive if it's not combined with hard work. So, they're the sort of things that I, you know, I would impart to my young daughters as they face this current career change.
Very good advice for all of us. So with that, this is it. Four quick questions as we say goodbye. What's your favourite food, Dagan?
Favourite food? Chinese.
Chinese. There you go. What's your favourite movie?
Favourite? You wouldn't believe this.
The Notebook?
Legally Blonde.
That's
my
good.
Daughters will love that. That's what took me to Harvard.
Of course it did. I can see you in a blonde wig. That's awesome. First album you ever owned.
Oh, God.
CD, music, whatever
CD,
it is.
CD, ACDC.
ACDC. That's good. And lastly, your favourite ice cream flavour?
Strawberry.
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 Really?
Yeah.
I don't get strawberry ice cream. But on that note, we'll take that offline. Thank you very much for spending some of your Friday with us today.
Thank you, Marina.
Thanks for listening in today. We look forward to you joining us next time.